Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.
You're very welcome along to Tuesday night's football show. It's Richie McCormack here with you until 10 p.m. wherever you happen to be joining us on the radio or indeed on our social channels. It is a big night in the Champions League. Liverpool, though, have finished off their business in fine style in Group E this evening. 2-0 winners away to Salzburg through goals inside a minute of one another, actually, from Naby Keita and then Mo Salah from the most acute of angles. Liverpool 2-0 winners away to Salzburg. Napoli 4-0 winners at home to Genk, and Andreas Milik hat-trick for them, helping them through in second position in Group E. Several teams, though, are on the bubble in terms of where they might go, namely Group F and Group H are most neatly poised. But in Group H, Chelsea leading Lille by 2-0. Those goals tonight coming in the first half from Tammy Abraham and Cesar Azpilicueta. Chelsea would appear to be heading towards the 3 points they need to go through. Elsewhere, Valencia leading away to Ajax through Rodrigo. So, as things stand in Group H, Valencia sit top on 11 points. Chelsea are second, also on 11 points. And Ajax, last season's Champions League semi-finalists, will be dropping into the Europa League. In Group G tonight, it's Benfica 0, Zenit St. Petersburg 0, the second half about to get underway in Lisbon. And RB Leipzig are currently 2-0 up away to Lyon. Two penalties, Emil Forsberg and Timo Werner from the spot for the Bundesliga side, who sit top of Group G on 13 points. We'll be going through his group winners. So it's between Lyon and Zenit as to who will be going through in second position. But we'll see if Benfica can turn that all around and get 3 points at the Stadio de Luz tonight. And tonight's other games are in Group F. Borussia Dortmund 1, Slavia Prague 1 is the latest from the Westfalenstadion. Second half has just gotten underway. A Thomas Suchek goal 2 minutes before halftime has thrown the cat amongst the pigeons. Jadon Sancho had Borussia leading by a goal to nil and looking to go through in second position behind Barcelona. But Suchek, his goal means that Inter are now in second position courtesy of their 1-1 draw as it stands with Barcelona. Carlos Perez had given Barca the lead. Romelu Lukaku equalised for Inter just before half time. And Damien Delaney joins us in studio. We were just commenting off air. I don't think any of us really appreciated, especially while he was at Chelsea, how good a manager Antonio Conte has turned out to be.
Yeah, look, he had obviously a fantastic spell with Juve and done very, very well at Chelsea. Unfortunately, beat, just remember him for that last little period. But I think he was probably edging for a way out when you look. He was quite argumentative, wasn't he? But it's the first time I've watched Inter at length this season, because I want to watch the Inter-Barca game. It's a fantastic game tactically. I mean, he really is. You could imagine their training sessions are just like repetitive drill after repetitive drill. The high press they're putting on Barcelona here is brilliant, and the timing of it and the intensity of it and the positional play of players is a joy to watch. And obviously he's very animated on the sideline as well, jumping around and pointing and directing the whole thing.
We should note that this Barcelona team, though, has been changed somewhat. There's no Messi. Yeah. They were through already as group winners, so they could take the foot off the pedal a little bit.
I don't think they have, though. I mean, you've got a lot of young players here, and Barcelona, being Barcelona, they're playing some really nice football. They're, you know, intent on playing out from the back. They really do want to. But Inter have caught them a few times with that full high press. Now, granted, I know it's not their starting 11, but it's still a testament to Conte of how well he has them organised and how well drilled they are. You know, the top of Serie A now by a couple of points. As it stands tonight, they're going to go through in the Champions League. So this could be a resurgence of some sort from Inter Milan.
We need more input from countries like Italy. I mean, like, Juventus can't be carrying that load forever.
I couldn't agree with you more. I really do. I mean, you know, the traditional Inters, ACs, Lazios, they just seem to have fallen so far behind. I know money plays a huge part in that, but you know, you look at this Inter team, and I do want to mention as well Lukaku. He's been absolutely stunning tonight. He really has.
It's great to see him motivated.
Yeah, he looks leaner. He looks trimmer. He looks an awful lot fitter than what he was. Conte's obviously got what he wants out of him, has him training well, and he looks confident. His link-up play is as good as I've seen it, if I'm being perfectly honest with you. Now, he is playing with a two up front with Martinez up alongside him. I mean, they are playing a 3-5-2 Inter, so he does have help. It's not just a lone roll where he's got to hold it. He's having nice little flicks inside to Martinez, and he's holding it up better than I think he could have done before. And he looks confident. He scored tonight as well with a fantastic volley from the outside of the box with slight deflection, but he's done really, really well.
We should note as well, there are 6 games in the Championship tonight. Leeds still scoreless at home with Hull, but elsewhere there have been a couple of Irish scorers. Shawny Maguire has opened the scoring for Preston at home to Fulham. They're approaching the hour mark at Deepdale, both sides with 10 men following sendings off in the first half for Dennis Adoy and Joe Rafferty for each side. But Shawnee Maguire opened the scoring in 23 minutes. David Nugent has just in the past 5 or 6 minutes scored a second for Preston. 2-0 up now at home to promotion hopefuls Fulham. Elsewhere, Millwall 1-0 up away to Bristol City through Jed Wallace. And Stoke City are 2-0 up at home to Luton. This is an 8 o'clock kickoff at the Bet 365. James McLean opened the scoring for Stoke tonight. The second as well coming from Joe Allen. James Collins playing for Luton but has picked up a booking in that one. The other game tonight sees Nottingham Forest and Middlesbrough scoreless. And some news as well that broke in the past while as regards the FAI. We'll get to it a little bit later on, but we're hearing of threats made against FAI staff in recent days, and Paul Cook talking about measures being taken to protect against those. That in more depth a little bit later on. We'll also hear from Luke Edwards on the upsurge in form for Newcastle. What's behind that, but why aren't they pulling in the crowds? But I want to talk to you, Damon, about a story that broke last night and took us all, I think, a little bit by surprise, which was Daryl Murphy. He, in an interview with Daniel Taylor in The Athletic, admitting that he had served last year between October and December a 6-week drugs ban because he had, in a test, shown positive signs of cocaine. Said that he regretted it immediately, said that, you know, he would never encourage anybody to engage in taking of illicit substances. But I guess we were just all thrown off guard because it's FA protocol that these things aren't named at the time. And that's, you know, that's their deal. We can't pry too deeply on that one. There are probably legal implications behind that as well. But just from anecdotal experience, would non-performance enhancing drugs, recreational drugs, I guess you call them, have much hold in the world of football at the moment?
It's not commonplace, no. I have heard of a few cases over the years. I knew of a couple of cases. Because the protocol, just so people understand, is if you... So Daryl Murphy got a 6-week ban, so it was obviously he was tested at training ground. So if you're tested on a Friday morning and you fail it, it's deemed non-competition. So you get a short ban. I thought you would have got more than 6 weeks, but whatever it was. But if you're tested on a Saturday after a game, you're in competition, it's an automatic 2-year ban. Hence what Jake Livermore actually got tested. We played Hull City at Selhurst Park, and that was the game he got tested in afterwards, and that's when the whole thing came out. And obviously Jake had some extenuating kind of circumstances and it got reduced. So Murph was obviously drug tested at the training ground. The protocol is that UK anti-doping only inform the club of the failure, and then it's up to the club to decide what they want to do, whether they want to go public or not. So that's why you often these things never are made public, because clubs will often protect the players. But I do know that when you get a ban, you're not allowed in the training ground. So it's a complete...
You're ostracised from football, essentially.
Right, you're not allowed in. So often what happens is... players will go back to their country of origin, or they'll be sent to a special rehab clinic somewhere, and they say, oh, he has a back injury and he's going back to France or wherever he's from, or going to a special clinic in Italy specializes in back injuries, and he's just sent away for 6 weeks, and that's how kind of clubs kind of I won't say cover up, but to just keep it all in-house, to be honest with you. I'm really surprised to hear that Murph did that, to be honest with you. Really surprised last night when I heard it. I'd be interested to see how it was made public, whether Daryl actually admitted himself in an interview or whether he was kind of broadsided by it himself. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the details of that, like, regardless, he clearly regretted the scenario. It's not something, obviously, he's a big boy, he's about 35 now, I think, at this stage, 36, playing for Bolton. I don't think
he left, I'm not justifying by any stretch of imagination, but he left Ipswich and he went to Newcastle and he didn't play for a couple of years. So you can imagine that, you know, when a footballer isn't playing, you got a time in your hands, maybe a certain amount of feeling, not saying for Daryl at all, but maybe a certain amount of feeling sorry for yourself, whatever. And he went to Forest, and I know he was kind of in and out there, and, you know, he was getting older, and you don't know what was going on in the guy's private life. There'll be a reason that he did it, because it's out of character for him. I wouldn't have thought that he would be the type that would have done that. And again, not justifying it, but you got to know all the facts, really, as to why he did it.
And how frequently would you have been tested as a player?
Yeah, very regularly. Very, very regularly.
How regularly is very regularly?
There's periods there where you could be tested 8 times a season.
you know, which is like once a month, like, you know.
Because the thought is the football is just carte blanche. It's like, there's people come in once or twice a year, maybe, if you're lucky.
See, like, when they come in, they obviously come in unannounced, you know, they come, I mean, there is big things with your whereabouts now and stuff, because you do have to give them 1 hour a day of your whereabouts, and ordinarily they give that as the training ground, and if they find out that you start training at say 10:30, they show up at 11, so everyone's on the training ground, and you see them walking across the pitches with their blue little bibs on of UK anti-doping and stuff, you know, and there'll be like 10 of them, you know, and then they'll just like stand and watch training, and then as soon as you're finished and as soon as the manager, they walk on the thing, and then you get assigned to a guy who will come up and say you've been selected for anti-doping, and then straight away you have to sign a form on the pitch to say, yeah, that's I understand what's happening, and then you can't, the guy won't leave your side then, so like, and then, you know, they won't let you go for a shower because, you know, in case you urinate in the shower, and then you say, oh, I can't go to the toilet, and you string the test out, and you know, it's a way of dodging it. So basically, they want to go for a shower, but you come in the change room, he'll sit next to it, and he's literally your shadow for the next, well, until you actually urinate, and then blood as well on top of that. So there'll be a nurse in the thing, so then you've got to go and have your bloods done. So that's kind of how it goes. They do show up about once a month, I'd have thought, unannounced, and then
at every club or just in Premier League, or
I don't know. Definitely in the Premier League. I don't remember, so, but you know, I think in the Premier League, yeah. But that's kind of the protocol of what goes on behind it. And then, you know, days that you're not in, you have to give your whereabouts. But usually the club phone in your whereabouts for you. They'll give it for like between 6 and 7 in the morning at your home address. Right, so then they'll say to you, like, this is, you know, you'll obviously be in bed on your days off and stuff like that, or if you're not at the training ground. So they'll say, this is your whereabouts, and if you're not there, you have to tell us so we can. So if you're gone away for the day, or you're away overnight or whatever, you have to tell us, because then we'll give your whereabouts for like 12 o'clock, between 11 and 12 o'clock that night for your home address. That's usually the way it works.
Are you surprised that recreational drug use is still prevalent in modern day footballers, given the amount of testing that you say is carried out, given the stringency of clubs' own in-house medical stuff we alluded to?
What I will say is players won't take drugs and just go, I don't care about football anymore, I'm just going to take drugs for the crack. There'll be an underlying issue, I would have thought, or, you know, not everyone, but I would say the vast majority, there might be depression issues, there might be homesick issues, loneliness, trouble at home, you know, like Jake Livermore's issue. Very rarely would a player get to the level that Daryl Murphy got to if he had that if he was wild child like that, you know, and if he would have been found out at 15, 16, 17 years of age, because everyone knows when you're coming up with football, he's a great player, but he's a wild child, and clubs just go, or trial, when they go on trial, people go, you know what, he's a bit mad, we need to stay away from him, you know, I mean, he's not well. So Murphy's obviously a very, very, very good professional. I've played with him, and I know him reasonably well. He's a very good professional, he's a fantastic teammate. I'm only putting two and two together and coming up with four. I might be wrong, but I would say that it was something to do with the fact that he's come to the end of his career. He wasn't playing very often. Maybe he was, I know he was living over in the UK on his own, and his missus and that was back in Waterford with the family. So I'm only guessing here, to be honest with you.
It's, I guess, from a physical standpoint, you would understand why players would err towards that rather than drink in 2019. Because drink is, it's a far more obvious thing in pretty much every way. Like, if you're going out for a rake of pints, like, it's going to show physically on you. Whereas this is something that could probably pass through your system relatively quickly for the same means to an end, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know about that, Rich. I don't know. I think if a player wants to let off some steam, you go and have a drink. Obviously, if you're doing it too regularly, it'll show you won't be training very well. You possibly pack on some weight, whatever it may be. As I said, there'll be an underlying reason as to why he did it.
People in the past tend to blame that downtime issue for footballers. Like, how, like, an example of what that would be for, like, if you're single, say, like, and you don't have the family at home to kind of entertain, you don't have the wife and kids, and, you know, you just have this vast expanse of a day. Like, how big a chunk of time are we looking at? How much time in solitude are you kind of looking at a day?
See, like,
or I know every player is different.
Every player is different. But, look, training grounds, you know, are like, state of the art, right? You've everything. You could spend
8 hours there, and you'd be happy, you know. Mm. You can go in the morning, have your breakfast. You could spend hours, you know, in after training. You know, you've ice cryotherapy, you've ice baths, you've masseuses, you've chiropractors, you've chiropodists, you've doc, you've everything. And then you get your lunch, and the chefs will be there, so you can have your dinner. So, you know, there's TV rooms, there's table tennis. So if you wanted to, you could stay in a training room from 8 in the morning till 5 in the evening, and more. And you know, you'd be around people, and you know, staff will always be there. You can watch videotapes. You've rooms with your with computers in it, so you can watch your performances. You can speak to the pro zone guys who will clip performances for you, who will clip opposition. If you're that way inclined, you can pass the day.
That sounds like, I don't mean to sound glib about this, that genuinely sounds like a nursing home. but you know what I mean? Like, if you have a nursing home described to you for an elderly relative, they'd be like, oh, there's activities to do, there's this and there's that, there's those people.
But if you're serious...
But then, like, the person in a nursing home is living there 24-7. Mm. You head out of that for, like, an 8-9 hour expanse or more during the day. Like, it's an awful lot of attention to just... Jesus, what do I do on my own here?
So if you want to go and you know, be in for 9:30 and training will be finished by say 12:30, you can rock in at 9:27 if you want and leave at 12:32 if you want. That's acceptable. And if you want to that way inclined, you can head off home and you can go to the cinema, you can watch Netflix, you know. For me, I used to always spend a lot of time in the training ground. Why not? There was yoga teachers there, there was everything. It was like, you could do anything you wanted there. So I would always just make it a point of just staying in the training ground and just, not because I was doing it just to pass time, it was just that, like, I have all this at my fingertips. This is going to make me better, so I'm going to use it, and I'm not going to go home and sit and watch, I don't know, daytime TV or whatever people do, you know? No, on my
stuff on daytime TV.
Yeah, I know, but if it was on my day off and stuff, I would always go to the cinema. I mean, I loved going to the cinema. I would happily walk in and sit, watch, as I've done before, we discussed with you, I would sit and watch back-to-back films on my day off in the cinema.
Yeah.
And then I would always make sure I cook my food. I would always go shopping, buy fresh food, and I would always cook it. And then I would go to bed early, because I got training tomorrow, so I'd always go to bed at like 9 or 10 o'clock. And
speaking of movies.
Go on then.
Have you seen that Films That Made Us thing on Netflix?
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
It's good stuff, isn't it?
One of the most nostalgic nights I had.
The Ghostbusters one floored me. I'm not going to lie. It was the, I'm not going to give anything away about it because I don't want to, because this story for me just made the thing. But there's a story involving Bill Murray, who obviously played Dr. Peter Venkman, and Egon Spengler as played by Harold Ramis. And the story of the two of them at the end, I'm not going to lie, I got a bit moist in the eye. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, I just stumbled on that one night, and me and my missus actually watched all four episodes back to back till about 2 in the morning, because one came on and then we were going to bed, and Die Hard came on, and I went, oh,
same for that.
And my missus was like, what is this Die Hard you speak of?
Of course, you've never seen
Die Hard. I was like, John McClane. And then you get the whole backstory of like how they didn't even want to cast him and stuff. So that was just unbelievable. Like, and how Hans Gruber ended up in the role, Jeremy Irons, was just brilliant as well.
It wasn't Jeremy Irons. Jeremy Irons played your man in Die Hard 3. It was Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman.
Joseph Takage.
Yeah, and then we were just going to go to bed, and then the credits just finished, and the next one started, and lo and behold, it was Dirty Dancing.
I haven't watched that one yet. I don't hear about it.
So we just sat there, and me and Mrs. just like going, oh my god, like, it just brought back such a good feel good factor about it, and how the movie was made, and two women's absolute like mission to get that film made, and how many times we must have been turned down 200 times, and you know, they just. Their perseverance, years and years and years, and this woman just had complete. Oh, it was brilliant. Watch it, or if you're our age, Rich, you know what I mean.
The movies that made us, it's on Netflix. It's just, if you've seen The Toys That Made Us, it's kind of along those lines. It's great. Bringing you up to date, what's going on in the Champions League? Chelsea still 2-0 up at home to Lille. Tammy Abraham and Cesar Azpilicueta, Frank Lampard's side. Valencia heading through with them. They lead through a Rodrigo goal in 24 minutes. Away to Ajax. All change in Group G because Benfica are now 2-0 up at home to Zenit St. Petersburg, who have been reduced to 10 men. Franco Cervi and Pizzi with the goals for Benfica. Douglas Santos sent off for Zenit tonight, but that won't be good enough for Benfica, who are still in third position, Zenit in second, and RB Leipzig topping that group on 13 points. They are 2-1 up now away to Lyon. Houssem Aouar has pulled one back for the league on side. Still Inter 1, Barca 1 in Group F.
But Borussia Dortmund have, through Julian Brandt, taken a 2-1 lead at home to Slavia Prague. So the lay of the land in Group E, or sorry, pardon me, in Group F at the moment, is Barcelona on 12 points, Borussia in second on 10, and then Inter having to make do, as things stand, of course, in third position and dropping down to the Europa League. There is 27 minutes to go in those games. Liverpool, as we know, heading through as Group E winners, a 2-0 win for them away to Salzburg. Napoli second in that group, 4-0 winners at home to Genk. We had in, as I mentioned, report tonight from the Irish Times, the FAI story has taken another turn, and another unsavoury one. It seems we found out today that they would not be appearing tomorrow at the Joint Oireachtas Committee for Transport, Tourism and Sports. They say they want to concentrate on the refinancing issues surrounding the association. The Irish Times report tonight saying that the Football Association of Ireland has reported threats made against its staff to the Gardaí and increased security measures on its campus in Abbottstown in West Dublin in recent days. In an email sent to staff last Friday, which was seen by the Irish Times, FAI Interim Executive Lee Paul Cook said the organisation was working in close partnership with Gardaí from Blanchardstown in relation to a number of postal incidents. So obviously it's letters and such being sent to staff in Abbottstown. It's understood a number of threats were made in letters received last week when the FAI published revised accounts showing it had liabilities of €55 million at the end of last year. Questions have since been raised about its viability in the face of such level of debt. Of course, we know Mr. Cook told staff that the association had put certain safety measures in place as a precautionary mechanism. He said staff are cooperating with the Garda investigation being supported by the FAI. A full review of security is being undertaken with an increased presence of security staff in Abbottstown. A number of our programmes may be disrupted over the coming weeks as we continue our risk assessment, said Paul Cook. A lunacy situation, and a really sad one if it's taken that turn, that people are having issues being threatened against them in Abbottstown. But the situation not getting any better. As we heard from Fergus O'Dowd earlier on in the show, it seems the FAI don't want to actually, on a public level, deal with this situation. That is Fergus O'Dowd's opinion, the head of that Joint Oireachtas Committee on Transport, Tourism and Sport. And Brian Kerr has been having his say on Virgin Media Sport tonight, and he reckons the FAI have bigger fish to fry right now than spend their time.
Have a problem with them not going to that tomorrow. I think that the remaining directors, Paul Cook in particular, but also the other new directors that come in after the last AGM, are obviously working very hard to try and tidy up some of the mess that's in place at the moment. And it is an absolutely crucial time. There's 200 employees waiting to hear what their future is. It was mentioned after that press conference last week that there would be consequences for the employees. So they're dangling. If they were to go, I think the mistake they made, and the communications there have been regularly quite poor. They put out a tweet on Sunday night saying they'd be available to go and meet the government and meet the Oireachtas. I don't have a problem with them not going to that tomorrow. I think that the remaining directors, Paul Cook in particular, but also the other new directors that come in after the last AGM, are obviously working very hard to try and tidy up some of the mess that's in place at the moment. And it is an absolutely crucial time. There's 200 employees waiting to hear what their future is. It was mentioned after that press conference last week that there would be consequences for the employees. So they're dangling. If they were to go, I think the mistake they made, and the communications there have been regularly quite poor. They put out a tweet on Sunday night saying they'd be available to go and meet the government and meet the Oireachtas committee. They shouldn't have done that, because obviously the work is very intense at the moment. And if they're trying to get something over the line with the banks, or an assurance from UEFA, or an assurance from somebody else that there will be funding there and money to pay the wages of those people coming up to Christmas and the new year, I think it's right that they don't go and waste time on it tomorrow. I think the time is absolutely crucial at the moment. And that would be for the politicians to have a little bit of a bashing session at this group. The only one of this group who's still in place, who was part of the regime that caused all the problems, is Donal Conway. And he needs to go. He said he's gone. He needs to go. There's one other gentleman, Hurley, who was around for a shorter period of time, less involved. But I think the other people While they were around and they sat on their hands a little bit and they didn't ask enough questions, Paul Cook wasn't. They're getting on with it and trying to fix it, and they should be given that this vital week to get on with that.
There you go. That's Brian Kerr speaking tonight on Virgin Media Sport about the latest goings on with the FAI, or in fact not goings on. And of course, Virgin Media Sport has over 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season, and is available to all Virgin Media TV customers. You can also download the TV Anywhere app. Check out the hashtag WeFreeSport for more. It seems that's the worst thing, I guess, that Brian mentioned there. It's 200 odd people who come close to Christmas have their jobs dangling by a thread and uncertainty as to whether or not they'll be there in the new year.
I mean, fairness to Brian Kerr, he does talk so much sense, doesn't he? You know, I mean, I know there's a lot of furore about these guys not showing up, but he's right. Donald Conway is the only one that will be there that could actually answer any questions, you know. So these guys are staying behind and they are doing their job, and they're probably working very, very diligently trying to save these people's jobs or trying to refinance it to a point where they can secure people's jobs as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. The people that are under scrutiny will have questions asked and they will have to answer them at some point. But I think the people that are there now are probably doing the right thing and just trying to move things forward and iron out the problems that they face.
No change to the Champions League scorers that we mentioned in the last couple of minutes, but in the Championship, Joe Allen has scored for a second time for Stoke City. At home to Luton, they now lead by 3-0. We mentioned Shawnee Maguire among the goals for Preston tonight. They lead 2-0 at home to Fulham. Nottingham Forest 1-0 up through Ryan Yates. At home to Middlesbrough, Leeds 1-0 up now at home to Hull City. In fact, make that 2. Ezgen Alioski has just doubled their lead. Jordi De Vice had put them 1-0 ahead at Elland Road tonight. Still to come, we will round up all that Champions League action and we will talk Newcastle with Luke Edwards. But Joe has been on via the text line as well. 5-3-106, if you want to get in contact tonight. We mentioned whether or not Damien would be regarded as a culchy. Living there on the show. FYI, Richie, the official definition of a culchy is, quote, an unsophisticated country person. By any measure, having lived in some of Britain's great metropolitan centres, Ipswich, Hull and Leicester, not to mention coming from Ireland's actual capital, that's debatable.
Good man, good man.
Damien is far from a culchy. That's from Joe. If anybody wants to redress that balance, by all means, get in contact with us on 5-3-106. We'll be back talking to Luke Edwards about Newcastle next.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.
Now, what's seldom is wonderful, we're always told, and it's always interesting, at least, to do a good news piece on Newcastle United, rarer than hen's teeth in recent years. And to talk about Newcastle in sunnier climes is the Telegraph's Luke Edwards on the line. Luke, thanks so much for joining us.
That's all right. Nice to speak to you.
It bizarrely is, in these circumstances. Everything's rosy in the Newcastle garden.
I mean, there were some of us in the summer who found the reaction to Steve Bruce's appointment a little bit over the top. I got the kind of the disappointment that Benitez had left, but there sort of just seemed to be this perception of Bruce as a hopeless journeyman manager, a dinosaur who'd had his time and had failed time and time again in the Premier League. But you obviously have to put Premier League management into context, and when you're in the Premier League with teams like Wigan and Sunderland and Hull, you're not necessarily going to have a great win percentage. And I argued in the summer that he was actually a far better manager than maybe his record suggested. And if you ask the fans of Birmingham, even Sunderland now, and certainly Hull City, who was their best manager of the last 10-15 years, and then Steve Bruce would probably win those contests. So he's done a good job. I think he's done a sort of in many ways an underestimated job, because although Newcastle spent that money in the summer, £80 million, £40 million of that unfortunately seems to have been blown on Joel Linton, Brazilian striker from Hoffenheim, who scored one goal and looks hopelessly out of his depth at the moment. So no, it's going really well, and I think slowly but surely the fans are coming round to Steve Bruce and the job he's doing, and to be top 10 at this stage of the season and sort of halfway to sort of a point safety target, I think it's been a fantastic start for them.
Yeah, to go into Christmas without the wailing and gnashing of teeth and looking over their shoulder and seeing the minimal amount of clubs, it's got to be a huge bonus for them. They've got players who have suddenly shown a great uptick in form. Like, I always thought, like, this is my own personal thing, it's completely irrelevant, but I always thought there was a really good footballer inside Jonjo Shelvey, and somehow Steve Bruce has managed to make that person show up in the last few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And I think one of Steve Bruce's greatest strengths, actually, if you talk to people who've played for him, is his man management. And look, I wrote a piece, I think in October, saying that Jonjo Shelvey's time had been and gone, and that he was on his way out and he couldn't run anymore, and, you know, he just wasn't good enough to play in the Premier League anymore. So there's me with a little bit of egg on my face, you know, a little bit of confession time. No, he's been... he said that he had a very niggly thigh injury for a long time, and I think that really started to hamper his mobility, and he was getting run around far too easily. He was just sort of, teams are sort of swamping, he got nowhere near anyone really, but his fitness seems to have improved. I don't know whether that's because of Steve Bruce or whether the injury has gone. And he's been fantastic. And, I mean, even when he didn't play that well against Southampton at the weekend, he then headed in the equaliser. That's 5 goals this season. That's his best return from midfield for Newcastle, and we've only played a third of the season. So, no, he's certainly responding to Steve Bruce. And I think that's an interesting aspect of the contrast between Benitez and Bruce. Benitez was a very cold manager, very analytical, didn't really talk to his players, didn't really ever praise them. And I think people like Jonjo Shelvey, Matt Ritchie, Jamal Lascelles, I think actually they'd become a little bit tired of Benitez's methods and just a little bit worn out by it, just with the lack of praise. And then someone like Bruce has come in, and he is very warm. He will take the time to talk to players and tell them where they're going wrong and what they're doing right. And I think that approach actually has lifted the dressing room in a funny way at the right time. That's not to have a go at the job that Rafa Benitez did, because he did an excellent job at Newcastle in the circumstances. But it's just funny how that change of manager and change of approach can actually bring out the best in players. And I think Jonjo Shelvey is one who would fall into that category. I think he's enjoying having a manager who talks to him and explains things to him and praises him. And that seems to be bringing out the best in him.
What's the Steve Bruce managerial setup like? Because it's not just all arms around shoulders and, come on, mate, let's just, like, you know, do our best and see where this goes and play for the shirt and all that kind of stuff. He clearly has a fairly canny backroom team around him, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's one of the great myths, wasn't it? That he would just come in and he was this guy who, because he, you know, was not particularly complex in what he said in the media, and didn't boast about, you know, talk about tactics or boast about things or his clever tactical tweaks. Everyone assumed he, again, was just this get up and go at them. No, he's got a very good backroom team. He's got Steve Agnew and Stephen Clements with him, who have been with him for a few years. They were with him at Hull, they were with him at Aston Villa and Sheffield Wednesday. They do a lot of the analytical stuff for sure, but Steve Bruce has managed, you know, he's managed a lot of games now. It's so tempting to write these people off as dinosaurs, but look at someone like Roy Hodgson at Crystal Palace. You know, people could say he's a dinosaur. He's 10, 12 years older than Steve Bruce, and he's still doing it now. I mean, managers can evolve. They can grow. They can, you know, they watch a lot of football. They can adapt to changing methods in the same way that someone that Rafa Benitez can adapt and change to methods. So no, Bruce has always been up on certainly football science and you know, the tactical innovation. So for example, against Manchester City in the 2-2 draw, it was actually Bruce who spotted that if you stop the short little balls into the feet of Sterling and De Bruyne, you would actually, to a large extent, you would nullify a lot of Man City's threat, because they'd become so used to just passing through those players, nice little intricate 1-2s, and they'd cut through the middle of defences. He just packed that area and didn't actually bother defending out wide, and just said, you know, effectively to Man City, you're going to be crowded out here, you'll have to go wide. And what, you know, Newcastle gambled was that if you give the fullbacks room, Kyle Walker and Mendy on that day, they're not actually that creative or good at delivering a ball into the box, and it worked for Newcastle. You know, admittedly they conceded 2 goals. However, they drew 2-2 with them, and for a large, they made Man City get incredibly frustrated by crowding them out of the middle. And I noticed when Man U beat them at the weekend, that was a similar tactic to Manchester United drew as well. So
yeah, I was literally
going to say
the same
thing. Stupid in any way, shape or form, but he does have what every manager has to have, is that those personal skills, those man management skills, and the ability to motivate his players, and we're seeing that.
One of those people who needed, I guess, a little bit of cajoling and to be brought back into the scene and maybe given a few games and given a bit of confidence fitness-wise is Kieran Clarke. From an Irish perspective, we've been delighted to see him get a string of 90 minutes over the past 9-10 games, played 45 against Southampton, but his return to form has been pretty marked.
He's, again, again, another one, you know, another one who I think if Benitez, and, you know, this is the thing that I don't think's really come out particularly. So I think there were probably four or five, maybe more players, I think, who would have been looking to leave Newcastle in the summer had Benitez stayed. And Kieran Clarke certainly falls into that category. He was sort of frozen out. They were playing Paul Dummett out there, even when they played three centre backs. It's pretty disheartening as a centre back, I think, if your manager's playing three centre backs and you're not one of them. And he's come back into the team again. He's another one who's responded to Bruce. And again, that's like changing management. And he's played really, really well. It's just a shame he's picked up a slight muscle strain. I don't think it's too serious, but it's probably going to rule him out for the next few weeks. But no, he's been playing really, really well. And you know, again, that is fantastic news for Ireland as well, because obviously they may well need him in the playoffs in March. But no, he's probably had his best run of form for Newcastle under Bruce, which again is a testament to the manager, really, and the work he's doing.
How's Big Andy doing?
Well, this is, I mean, he's enjoying himself. That's clear. Came on against Southampton, completely changed the game. Unfortunately, Newcastle had effectively been playing with 10 men. Joe Linton was that bad. And he's fit. How long he's going to stay fit, we just don't know. So I think literally you have to take it on a week-by-week basis. But against Southampton, he looked leaner, more athletic, sharper, quicker than he had done for several years. So I think this second ankle operation that he had in the summer has certainly helped. It doesn't appear to be swelling up anymore after games. So that was a problem when he was training earlier in the season. His ankle would swell up and he'd have to have two or three days off. Now, that's not great for a professional athlete in any sport, but certainly in football. So, but he's training every day now. He's very happy with the ankle. And, you know, he's only 30. He's only 30 years old. So if you can keep Andy Carroll fit, if you can get, you know, 30 appearances out of him, you've got a hell of a player there. Because actually, as we saw against Southampton, when he's fit and firing, there aren't many better strikers of that ilk in the Premier League. And if he stays fit for Newcastle, then, you know, that's absolutely fantastic news, because the way they play, the formation they play with sort of a target man and Almiron and St. Maximum running pace either side of them, it makes them very, very devastating on the counter-attack. So if Andy Carroll stays fit, I think Newcastle can certainly start to think about a top-10 finish.
Yes, and Maximum's one of those rough-and-ready kind of players. He seems fairly raw to be, you know, I guess a bigger manager, for want of a better term, would be smoothing those edges off. But Bruce has managed to find a way to make them work for him.
Yeah, he's an incredible player, actually. There's been a few things written here about him being a bit of a flop in England because he didn't have any assists or anything like that. But honestly, he completely transformed the way Newcastle played. And what you have when you watch him live is that when he gets the ball, the opposition team now, it's not two defenders coming back, it's three defenders, two midfielders and the fullback. So that naturally creates space for other players, which is important. But also, as we saw against Southampton, you can put three players on him and he may well still dribble around them, and frequently does. I mean, I'm not entirely sure he knows what he's going to do when he gets the ball. But I think that also makes it impossible for defenders to analyse tapes and work out what he's going to do, because there is no pattern to his play. There is no sort of reason to his play. There's no sort of, he doesn't do the same things two or three times in a game. It's always, you know, improvised. So he's been fantastic for them. Yes, he's very rough. There's probably a reason why a player that talented is at Newcastle as well, because he obviously is a bit of a rough diamond, and I think he's fairly hard work off the pitch sometimes. I think he's a bit of a character, a bit of a free spirit, but he's been absolutely wonderful for Newcastle and again, a huge part of what they've done. And again, credit to Steve Bruce, because he is a difficult player. You know, does he come back and do his defensive work? I don't know, but probably not as often as the manager would like, but he is so important to the way they play, and he's played such a big role in the recent good results.
All that, and we still have to talk about dwindling attendances at St James's Park. Mm. They this week announced this scheme to offer existing season ticket holders a free half-season ticket, but this is all an effort to try and offset the fact that they only got 42,300 and change in for the Southampton game.
Yeah, and this is the kind of the apathy that's grown. This is the lasting impact, really, of Benitez leaving. I think Benitez whipped everybody up into such a frenzy in those last few months, and it was always been this case that if Rafa left, a lot of fans said they would never step back into Newcastle, and Rafa did leave. I think the club maybe, and maybe Steve Bruce, and I think all of us probably thought that maybe 2,000 or 3,000 of those people would eventually sort of begin to drift back in, but they haven't been. That tells you everything about how disastrous the Mike Ashley years have been, that actually you got Newcastle fans to the point, a generation of them anyway, who are willing to give up, who don't want to go to the games anymore. And actually, we were sort of estimating the numbers were probably between 5,000 and 8,000 who'd boycotted, but actually I think there's been a lot of season ticket holders locked into a 10-year deal who weren't going either. So I think the crowds have been about 10,000 down, which again is a huge statement of disillusionment, not at Steve Bruce as such, but I don't think his appointment helped. I don't think that captured people's imagination. But the interesting thing is that they haven't come back, even though results have been good and the team have been doing well under Bruce. And I think that is the level of anger there is towards Mike Ashley. Whether that achieves anything in the long run, I don't know. From what I hear, the club's no closer to being sold now than it was a year ago. So, you know, the club have done this idea that they're going to give away 10,000 free season tickets as a thank you to those who have stayed loyal to the team and who have kept their season tickets. So it'll be interesting to see whether that boosts the crowds. From what I'm told, the uptake has been remarkable. So I think we probably will see the stadium full again. So you can be cynical about these things. You can have a go at the club and you can, as I have done several times, but actually I think this is a pretty good gesture, actually, because I think they would have probably got a bit of an uptake on half-season tickets anyway. But to give them away for free, I think it's a nice gesture, and I don't really think you can criticise them for it.
There we go. It's an upbeat tone all around Newcastle United. Luke, this has been brilliant.
Yes, lovely. Well, I'm happy for a change, so there we are. Wait till I get back to Ireland for March for the playoffs.
Don't talk about the war. Luke Edwards from The Telegraph, thanks so much for coming. Taking time even to talk to us this evening. There you go, it's Luke Edwards, and the good news story for once that is surrounding Newcastle United. Bad news for Inter tonight, though. They have just gone down 2-1 at home to Barcelona. Barca's latest wonder kid, Ansu Fati, coming off the bench with a low drive to the bottom left-hand corner of the Inter goal and breaking Inter hearts. Inter just needed a goal as things stood to go through behind Barcelona in that group as runners-up. But now trailing by 2-1, Inter look like they will be dropping into the Europa League with Dortmund leading at home to Slavia Prague. Andy Carroll came up in that conversation with Luke Edwards there. What was he like to play against? I'd imagine it was not fun.
Yeah, he's such a big, aggressive man, you know, very, very strong. I remember we played against him when he was at West Ham, and Sam Allardyce used to just, you know, bring him on after about an hour and just clip balls on the diag to him, and he'd start on, like, say, our left back, and then the ball would be hung up right above your head, and, you know, you know full well he's coming and he's going to, like, absolutely poleax you. You know you're not going to win the header from a standing jump against him, and you know he's got to run up against you. So you basically just try and jump 2 yards behind the ball so he's got to go through you to get to the ball. And then hope to God that, you know, you're basically just trying to stop him getting a clean header on the ball. What you'd want is Andy Carroll arriving with a 10-yard run and meeting it flush on his forehead, because he could power them in. So when they got hung up in the 6-yard box, you're jumping, like, underneath the ball, but like 2 yards towards him, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
So he's just got to go right through you. So you just know you're just going to get absolutely battered for the 30 minutes that he's on, because Sam Allardyce will just keep on doing that. You know you're going to win him, but your sole job there is just trying to stop him winning him cleanly.
The physical nature of that and the way he plays has got to have taken its toll and played a part in his injury profile over the past few years.
Yeah, definitely. He's a big man as well. You know, he carries weight, but he's got a big frame. Do you know what I'm saying? He's not, like, mobile. He's not, you know, I can't imagine, you know.
He's not winning 40-yard dashes anytime soon.
No, you know, I can't imagine being ultra-professional, doing yoga and all that, carry on, like, so. But he's done ever so well. I mean, it's surprising to hear he's only 30 in that interview.
That's the thing, yeah.
I was actually going, what? Surely not. I thought he was at least 33 or 34.
Been around for so long.
He has, right?
I think the talk around him has been one that he's kind of frail in terms of injuries, and he's been out for so long and so often that you think of him as being an older age profile player, when in actual fact he's just turned 30 and probably should have had a few more of his best years in the last couple
of
years.
When you look at the amount of injuries he's had, he has probably got the body of a 38-39 year old.
Yeah.
But, like, Newcastle signed him for, like, bringing him on with 10 minutes after losing a game 1-0 or drawing
one wonder trying to get a win, you know, because if you just drop balls up to him, he probably is, you know.
It'll cause a bit of damage, like.
Oh, he could cause absolute carnage. If you've got a team pinned in on the edge of their own 18-yard box and you're defending a lead and Andy Carroll comes on, you know, got to start thinking about getting up the pitch because you don't want to be camping on the penalty spot because eventually he is going to, you know, create something or score something. So, you know, have to start thinking about getting out the box, getting to the D at least, so he's not getting efforts on goal. And if he is getting knockdowns or shots from distance, so he would definitely alter how you would defend if you saw him coming on.
Should mention as well, on a Newcastle tip, the sad news this evening that one of their former managers, Jim Smith, you may know as being an ex-manager of Oxford United, of Portsmouth, of Derby County as well, has passed away at the age of 79. He had a hand in a lot of great players' careers over the years. He brought John Aldridge to prominence at Oxford, remember. He had a hand in Darren Anderton's rise at Portsmouth, and he got the last great spell out of Paul McGrath as well. While at Derby County, I believe you briefly crossed paths with Derby
County. Yeah,
Smith,
I was playing a reserve team game not long after I went to England in 2000, I think I went over, and it was one of my first few games. And I actually got sent off. We were playing Derby in a reserve team game, because they were actually called reserve team games then as well. And it was at the baseball ground in Derby, so like not even Bride Park. I remember getting sent off and I got absolutely destroyed by Gary Parker, was the reserve team manager, and he absolutely, I can't even remember what I got sent off for. But I remember walking out feeling really down about myself, and he was manager of Derby County at the time. I remember he just put his hand around me and said, "Don't worry about it, son, happens to us." You know, just nice words of encouragement, because you're kind of going home thinking, "Oh my God, I've just been sent off, or the manager hates me." And he didn't need to do that. And at the time, he was the first team manager of Derby, just watching the reserve team game. So I remember going home feeling a little bit better about myself, and he just, you know, always stuck with me because he was such a nice man. He seemed like a genuine kind of fella, you know.
There you go, Jim Smith. More after this.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Geoff and Heskey.
Back, time enough to tell you that Inter have crashed out of the Champions League, a 2-1 defeat at home to Barcelona. That Ansu Fati goal breaking Antonio Conte's heart at the San Siro. Barca through as group winners. Borussia Dortmund out of Group F in second position. Inter dropping in to the Europa League. Chelsea, they are through, 2-1 winners at home to Lille tonight. And not even that late goal from Loic Remy could keep things interesting. Tomorrow morning, OTBAM is live at 7:30 on offtheball.com, OTB Sports Radio, and the Go Loud app, and on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Tomorrow's head-to-head in our sporting moments of the decade pits Stephen Cluxton's All-Ireland winning free kick against Galway, winning their first Liam McCarthy after a wait of 29 years. We'll reveal the winner on tomorrow night's show. We are live from 7. Damien Delaney will be back alongside Johnny Ward. We'll have Man City, Spurs, Real, Bayern all in action. You're in tomorrow morning as well, I guess.
Yeah, I got roped into that.
You fool. Tom Dunn is up next. We'll talk to you tomorrow morning.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Geoff and Heskey.